Perfect.
See you next week.
See you next week for Buy Nothing Friday.
Nah, that's 2 weeks from now.
Oh, sorry.
No, this is it.
There comes a time.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:03 a.m. And coming up this morning, we've got Political Perspectives. Eric Ascade is taking the day off. We're going to hear Flashpoints with continuing coverage of the police and drug gang kidnapping of 42 students in the Mexican state of Guerrero. Also, an interview with a doctor who confronted FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler about net neutrality. At 11 on the Digital Divide, part 5 of Startup City, how the new tech boom is changing Portland. Interviews with Retraction Watch co-founder Ivan Oronsky and Tom Schroeder, author of the controversial book Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not currently a KBOO member, you can remedy that situation at kboo.fm. You just click where it says donate today. And now, this.
I'm out to sing songs that'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, No matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Movin' On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
Hi, I'm Omar Carrillo Pinajero. I'm with Neighborhood Partnerships.
And now we hear The State of Affordable Housing, Influences and Tools for the Future of Our Region with speakers Justin Burry of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Omar Carrillo Pinajero of Neighborhood Partnerships, and Cameron Witten, community activist. This was recorded in October as part of the 12th Annual Regional Livability Summit. The theme of the summit was Pathways to Prosperity, Advancing Economic Justice. The panel begins with Justin Burry asking the other two panelists to introduce themselves.
I'll let Omar introduce himself. Hi, I'm Omar Carrillo Pinajero. I'm with Neighborhood Partnerships, which convenes the Housing Alliance.
Hi, I'm Cameron Witten. I'm a community advocate in Portland, and affordable housing is one of those issues really close to my heart.
We're kind of going to talk about different aspects of what we see as the current trends in housing and affordability, both here in Portland, but kind of looking at some national trends. So I'm going to try to set the stage by looking at some of the bigger things that are happening that are affecting what's happening here in Portland. And I think that a lot of us see a lot of development that's going on right now after we had very little development for a long period after time out of 2008 and have questions about, well, who are we building for and what does that all mean to affordability? So I'd like to start there. One thing that we've seen since the housing crisis and the financial crisis of 2008 is a deepening inequality, and what that has led to is ultimately kind of two housing markets bifurcating, splitting off, two housing markets for two Americas. And so for the people that have money and that are really well off, they're able to capitalize on a lot of these gains. So we've seen record low interest rates since 2008. The Fed has, through what they call quantitative easing, has done whatever they can to keep pushing money into the markets, keeping interest rates low, which it can be good for housing because it makes mortgage interest slow, but it also gets more credit and more loanable funds to people like Wall Street and investors. And what that means is that there have been some incredible deals on foreclosed properties or short sales or underwater homeowners and distressed properties, and that we've seen a lot of cash payments for these types of properties. Just in 2013, almost 43% of all houses sold in the U.S. were all cash payments, which is pretty unprecedented. And even we're seeing institutional, like private equity firms, getting into the housing market, buying up large swaths of housing that's usually kind of in distressed areas, and turning them into rental housing. And what's worrying about that is that they have bought those properties and guaranteed their investors a certain amount of yield when it comes to what those properties will generate. And they may not have the experience of renting properties and knowing what it takes. And if they don't see that kind of investment, then what happens? That means that they're raising rents or that they are not actually making repairs and those kinds of things. What does it mean for the people living in those houses is certainly a frightening thing. And then, you know, you see a real bump in the housing market in 2013. Portland experienced like a 15 to 20% increase in the price of homes during that time. And a lot of it that was fueled by some of those low interest rate and those investors getting back into the game kind of
all of a sudden and really spiking the interests. I was on the housing market just this year, and it was kind of a scary place to be because we had a lot of different offers in, and we kept getting beat, not even just price-wise, but just because they were all cash offers. And then we would see that house come back on the market after being renovated maybe 3 or 6 months later, and they would be completely unaffordable. And so what does that mean for the rest of us, the people that don't have large reserves of cash lying around? And we know that, you know, there are economic trends, like the fact that a lot of the jobs that have come back are lower paying service type wage jobs that are more that are less stable. And that means it's more difficult for people to buy homes because they don't have that history of income that it's enabling them to get into buying a house. Or sometimes they also have bad credit because they were foreclosed on or because they had a medical emergency. So they're having trouble getting into even rental housing. Student loan debt is playing a huge role in our housing market these days, where people aren't qualifying for loans, or it's taking such of a chunk of their income that they're unable to make rent because they're not able to get the job that they were promised when they started school, and those loans are not dischargeable, and so, you know, sometimes they're getting their wages garnished, those kinds of issues. And you're also seeing low household formation, which means that people that historically are moving from rental housing, starting a family, getting married, whatever that kind of stage in life is, that's happening at a much later stage in life for folks, especially people in what they call the millennial generation, people born, you know, kind of 1980 to 2000. And so they're staying in the rental market longer, and that means that we're not seeing the normal type of progression across the housing spectrum that you normally would. And additionally, people that have lost their homes in the foreclosure crisis are going back into rental housing, and that means that there's a higher rental housing population, and we haven't necessarily caught up with that demand, so that puts pressure on the rental market, and that's why you're seeing a lot of the rent increases that we're seeing in the Portland area, among other reasons. And this demand is also very much at the lower end, but also the higher end. So people that would normally become homeowners are staying renters, but they're crowding out other renters because they're able to pay a little bit more rent than someone who would be normally renting that unit. And then when development comes, the developers are noticing, oh, well, we have this kind of group of people that would normally be homeowners that are renters, and so that is where the biggest return in our development is, and so we're going to target that particular demographic for this new rental homes, which means that that's less rental units that are coming online that are new for maybe people that are making a little bit less. And in Portland, we're seeing record low vacancy rates that we've never seen before. Portland, you know, whether we're getting beat out by Sacramento or New York City, it's usually within the top five metro areas that I've seen the lowest rental rates in the nation. And Portland and Oregon are actually seeing the highest in-migration in the country right now. And so people are moving here, and we're not able to keep up with all of the demand that's coming. And this low vacancy rate and increasing rental rates not only has implications for your average renter or your average person trying to buy a home, but it has even more consequences on people with lower incomes. And what my organization does is we talk to people on our renters' rights housing hotline, and we hear that because they're not able to have choice in the market, that there's more incidences of discrimination. They're unable to get repairs because the landlord says, well, if you don't like it, you can leave, and they can't leave because there's nowhere else on the other side. They're getting denied more because they have blemishes on their record. And so they're unable to get into housing in the first place. You're seeing more no-cause evictions where the landlord just simply says, I don't need to give you a reason. I'm just simply evicting you because I want to, because I know I can re-rent it immediately. And so if you try to stand up for your rights in some way, if you try to get a repair or anything like that, you're getting a termination notice, or you're getting a threat of that termination notice. And so people are much more willing to live with mold and leaky pipes, lack of heat, because they know that if they ask, that they could be risking getting an eviction and then being really kind of out in the seas of a really tight rental market right now. And so that has implications across the board, not just with how much you can afford, but your experience when you're living in that unit. And so, you know, when we see kind of this split that's happening with the housing market, that has an implication on what gets developed and how that development occurs here in Portland. If you have investors buying pieces of properties with cash and either flipping or renovating them, or they're tearing them down completely to build a larger, more luxurious single-family home, then that has severe impacts on the affordability writ large. And so when we think about who we're building for or why that's being built, it's important to kind of keep those larger trends in mind so that we are able to adopt policies that might really target exactly what the issue is on the ground at the moment. And so, yeah, I told you my own experience about kind of being trying to buy my own home. We put in 20 offers, and you know, that was kind of a record at the time. And we kept getting beat because people were buying with cash. And often the developers say, well, these homes need to be tore down because they're falling apart anyway. That's simply not the case. These are good, you know, $200,000 homes that can house a small family, and they're being replaced with 5,000 square foot homes that, you know, also for a family, but with a family with higher means. And what's happening with rentals is that also rental housing stock is being torn down and sometimes being replaced with home ownership opportunities. Or sometimes they're building more luxury luxury or higher-end rental housing on top of that. Now, it's important to not draw the line between, okay, well, we should just stop demolitions and stop any construction of any sort, because sometimes if you're increasing the supply, if you're building more housing, period, then you're at least able to try to keep up with the demand, but that's just simply not enough. And so we do have changing demographics in Portland and in the region as a whole. And I don't have like super specified data in this. These are just kind of anecdotal trends. We're seeing older people with means moving to Portland with families or empty nesters that are looking for a quality of life kind of experience, urban experience. And so they're able to purchase homes or buy really nice condos in areas that have high amenities and with high opportunities. And then you're also seeing kind of that Portlandia demographic of people that may be college educated that are moving to Portland because they are attracted to the lifestyle, but they might not be coming here with a job. And so they might be occupying kind of service level jobs until they're trying to figure out what kind of career they're looking for. And so they may not have the means at the moment to try to get into some of that kind of higher end housing. And then you have an explosion of people of color, whether they're having kids here, because most of our school systems are, especially in East Portland, where there's the highest growth, are majority people of color and immigrants from different countries. And so when you have those kinds of three exploding demographics, you know, how do you provide housing for all three of those and not just the first two? And what does it mean when we talk about where we build housing and who is it for, is essentially the question that we always need to be asking ourselves. And so when we think about that different groups have different housing needs, you know, a lot of times what would they call protected class members. So we have this under the civil rights, and they talked about this quite a bit at the lunchtime session, how we have different groups of whether it's based on race or ethnicity, they have different housing needs and they have different housing barriers. So their ability to get into housing and stay into housing is different based on their if they belong to a protected class. So are they a person with a disability that has special needs? Are they a person that's elderly that has different needs? Are they a family with a large family that needs more bedrooms? And so just simply saying more housing across the board and everything will kind of the market will figure it out is just not the case. And so Portland has a duty to affirmatively further fair housing, to make sure that it's meeting the needs of all those protected classes and that it's not contributing to the concentration of poverty and the segregation that's taken place in the past and continues whether it's through forced displacement or what have you. And so when we think about issues of infill and density and demolitions, it's not simply a yes or no question. And an anti-demolition sentiment that says, let's just keep everything as it is, will only exacerbate the issue. Like, for instance, the neighborhood of Westmoreland is asking to downzone their neighborhood in the next comprehensive plan because they really like the character of their neighborhood, which can sometimes mean for our housing folks like me, we don't want new people coming moving here that might disrupt our way of life or that might live differently than us. And so those are ways in which, when we talk about structural racism that they were talking about at lunch, those are very coded ways in which to preserve that kind of inequality that exists and perpetuates itself. And so just by relaxing zoning laws and saying, yeah, you can build as much as you want, that's really not going to get to all of the different needs that people have. And so it's important to, when we hear from Omar about the different types of policies that are in place, who is this serving and where is the demand coming from is a really key question. And also recognizing that we can't do this without resources. We can't just have this really quick fix of saying, yeah, you can build more here, or you can do a quicker development time here. There's no, you know, technology app that's going to get us to housing affordability. It takes money. And we have been kind of skirting around that for a really long time. And so it's in time for us to show what kind of values we have as a community and make sure that we have housing opportunities for everybody who needs some.
Yeah. All right. So to introduce myself again, I'm Omar Carrillo Tinajero, and I'm with Neighborhood Partnerships. Just for brief background, Neighborhood Partnerships convenes the Oregon Housing Alliance, which is a statewide coalition of advocates, local jurisdictions, nonprofit developers, for-profit developers, so basically organizations and individuals who want to advocate at the state level for more resources and policies that expand and create opportunity for housing throughout Oregon. I kind of want to underline a lot of what Justin said about the need and don't want to get into the details, but for those of you who like looking at numbers, I'm going to pass out what we call our need sheets and that we use when we talk to legislators and other advocates to really underline kind of the state that we're at, not only on the rental side or at the homeownership side, but also the number of folks in our communities who are experiencing homelessness and just really need those resources to get them into housing. And as Justin mentioned, these are all related. And when we see such high numbers for to buy a home, that affects the number of people, the rent prices and the number of people who are able to afford, and it starts pushing people out of communities, and it leads to all these other things that are bad for our communities that Justin briefly talked about. And I also want to kind of underline another thing that I heard Serena Boston Ashby from the Portland African American Leadership Forum mention recently at a City Club lunch, and that's that displacement and the, you know, affordability issues when in regards to housing have been something that have affected communities of color and specifically the Black community in Oregon and specifically in our metro region in Portland and our farm worker communities in the rural parts of our state and here in this region. I think she mentioned that one of the reasons why talking about affordable housing has become such a hot button issue and we're now talking more about it is because it's affecting middle class white people more specifically in this region. So I really want us to have that as we have this conversation to keep that in mind and that, as Justin mentioned, housing affordability affects different populations differently, and there's a history with each different community of how they've experienced it and how we should address when we think about these tools and how we address them as they relate to each of these populations. With that said, I kind of want to start by saying that things are bad in Portland, and they're bad across the state. I mean, we have these need sheets for every county, and they look bad across the state. There's just such a need for housing. To give a couple examples, the current private market rental vacancy rate in Central Oregon in the Bend area is estimated at below 0.5%. And we know what that does for people who are seeking housing in that area and people who are working there, specifically in the big service sector there, have to live out in the outskirts of that community, out in Redmond, if they're working in Bend, etc. In Hood River, employers are delaying expansion plans because of lack of housing options for their workers who are earning modest incomes as well. And for the various reasons that Justin underlined, the market isn't going to fix this. It isn't going to fix this anytime soon. And we really need tools and funding to address this. And with that, I kind of want to talk a little bit about the Affordability Balance and Choice Work Group, which is a legislative work group that came out of the effort to lift the ban on inclusionary zoning in the 2013 legislative session. And Justin and Cameron were both very involved with that effort, and the Housing Alliance had it on our support agenda. But it was really these folks and their organizations leading that effort that led to us coming together in this work group that started late in 2013 and kind of is wrapping up now and presenting concepts. The Housing Alliance currently has no position on inclusionary zoning. What kind of came from this work group was, from the very beginning, it was going to be a consensus-driven work group, and as the work group continued to meet, it was clear that inclusionary zoning was not something that the work group was going to come to a consensus about. And so with that, we began to exploring other options and other things that we could do and we can present as a package to the legislature to push for more resources and other policies that were politically and policy-wise easier to achieve. And I mean, personally, I think many of the members of the Housing Alliance think it's ridiculous that we have the ban and that we can't use this tool in our local jurisdiction. And we think that it would provide options and opportunities for development and creating affordable housing. But in this work group, I think there was the recognition that we could come to a consensus and present to the legislature these other policy options that were not going to attract as much opposition. People were going to be actively fighting against them and then be able to create more pots of money. Specifically, these are drafts that kind of just came out. The work group has not kind of finalized which of these we're going to pursue, but a lot of them just focus on expanding the money available for affordable housing development. And something else that, I mean, one of the underlying things that came from the work group was that, as Justin mentioned, the big thing that we needed to kind of wrap our heads around was that there has been such a disinvestment at all levels, particularly at the federal level, but also at the state and city levels, in how we invest in housing and how we think about creating housing that is affordable for all members of our community. And this disinvestment has really led us to a place where we're kind of struggling to find creative ideas, but at the end of the day, we just don't have money, and we need the money. And that's kind of something that the work group was really grappling with at the time, and which is why I think the couple of things that we chose to kind of pursue focus on that. The other thing that came out is kind of lifting the conversation to that higher level of what are the competing priorities and what are the intersections between the different systems that are competing against each other, our transportation systems, our land use system, and where can we align those better so that they're not in competition with each other, both for resources and then also for development. How do we make it so that when an affordable housing developer wants to develop in a particular community, there aren't all these roadblocks that are put in place so that that housing that will be affordable for more people is delayed and then essentially driven out of that community. How do we address NIMBYism, not in my backyard, in certain communities, and what policies can we push, maybe not necessarily new laws, or but how do we make sure that whatever is in our comprehensive plans, whatever zoning, we can actually build and move forward with easily and don't run into these roadblocks. So I think part of what the work group realized is that they're like thinking higher is essentially what we want to do. And some of the things that are being passed around don't sound particularly exciting, but I think it's a first step in really thinking about that. And there is a proposition that the work group will continue to meet to think about these higher level processes and how do we align our goals as a state and as a region and city so that they're not in competition with each other.
Can I just expand upon that? Because I sit on that HABC, and one of the things that I would say is a good, a positive thing besides the resource conversation is that there are there were private developers and nonprofit developers around that table, and they don't actually often get a chance to work together. And they both suffer from the same types of roadblocks. And a lot of it relates to the roadblocks that he was talking about. Sometimes it's kind of certain regulation barriers, but then a lot of it can be they've done all that they have to do, and then one particularly the vocal group shouts them down and blocks the development. And in some ways, that's great. That's democracy happening. That's people voicing, their interests. But I think that there can be a difference between a development that's going in, that's tearing down what was once affordable, and then building something that's super fancy and maybe not as affordable, versus people not wanting to, maybe imagining that they value affordable housing, but just not right in their neighborhood. And thinking about, are there ways in which that when we're looking at a development or a redevelopment, what are the social benefits and the social costs of that process? And so is there a value in what's being created that is not necessarily across the board, no matter what you build, because what you build does matter. And so, and cities and counties and jurisdictions spend millions of dollars planning for what their zoning codes are and what their housing needs are. But then when all of that is derailed because there isn't that political will or that other voice that's talking about why this particular type of housing is necessary in our community, those are great costs. And that's what hurts us from sometimes getting to some of the goals that we're trying to achieve. And that certainly was part of the discussion that happened at the HABC, even though it was a little bit troublesome to us that inclusionary zoning was not as discussed as much as we had hoped. That was one thing that we identified as being a positive.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Again, my name is Cameron, and I'm going to talk about some of the housing issues that are happening here in our local community. That includes Portland and the greater metro area. I'm going to start off with metro. This is going to be a brief one, but it's probably been around 2 decades since they've been significantly involved in the conversation about housing affordability. But last year, they started the Metro Equity Strategy Advisory Committee, and affordable housing started being brought up a lot since then, especially considering the fact that, rents went up 6% just in Portland last year. It's a really big deal. And so just 2 months ago, Metro actually allocated funding to hire a senior policy advisor just on affordable housing. And the idea of that is to just get a person within the metro area who's working with local jurisdictions, making sure they're knowledgeable about the tools that are available, and really trying to convene staff to make plans happen within these communities. One of the things that is an issue is that Portland has some of the highest concentration of the subsidized public housing, and Metro is looking for ways to really get more of regional partnership going towards that. Other than that, they also have a grant program that this policy advisor is supposed to be working with local nonprofits who do work within the community, who serve constituents of that community, helping to also move that conversation forward. Other than that,
that's just starting right now. And so it's a great time to be involved, you know, talk to your counselors and really figure out how do we continue to move that conversation forward. City of Portland, there's a really dramatic shift that's happened recently. There's a new city council has come in, the bureaus have been reassigned, and what I've seen is a trend where we've shifted from, instead of talking about diversity of housing, especially low-income housing, there's been a talk more about workforce housing. And we've seen that in a lot of different policies that have been passed or that are currently being planned to be passed. First, I want to talk about Chinatown. There was recently a development deal that was made where it forgave SDC fees, which stands for System Development Charges. And that money is paid for every development that happens in an area, and it goes towards sewers, parks, a lot of the other physical things that have to happen to make sure that community is livable and prosperous. And so what you see a lot happen is SDC fee waivers are waived in order to, have some kind of covenant on housing affordability. And so in Chinatown, it was agreed upon that there would be workforce housing developed between 80% to 120% of median family income, which is really new for that area of town, which is seeing more subsidized housing and more nonprofit work being done for low income people between 0 to 60% MFI. My biggest critique of that plan is that there's a 10-year sunset on that for at least the 80%, and then there's a 15 if you're at the 120%. That basically means that within 10 to 15 years, that housing will no longer have any guarantee of subsidized rent of affordability. And so that's an issue that's coming up right now. Also, we've seen within the comprehensive plan, which is currently being testified on, is the issue of low-income housing being included, especially within the West Quadrant plan, where if you look at the overlying goals or the equity goals in the plan, there's mention of low-income housing, but if you actually look within each of the neighborhoods, there's actually no talk about affordable housing. We talk about workforce, student housing, senior housing, urban family. But one of the issues, once again, that we're seeing is that there's not really the conversation about within 30, 35 years, where is the diversity of housing going to be in Portland? And so that's some things happening right now that's related to the Housing Bureau. I also want to talk about what is being done right now. As mentioned earlier, there's a lot of issues being happening, especially within areas like Selwood, where they're talking about easing the height maximums for certain neighborhoods. There's also been the increase of parking minimums in areas like Division, and that has real implications on how affordable housing is. And part of that is exclusionary zoning, because there's a certain amount of square footage and there's a cost with that, and we're losing the ability to have flexibility within that. One thing that's become really popular to talk about is the tiny homes movement. And the idea behind that is to create tiny home communities that really allows people flexibility of their size and the amenities that are within their homes. And currently, tiny homes, are between 300, 700 square feet. So they're really tiny. You've probably seen it on the Home and Life Family Channel or something. There's a little show about that where people are actually giving up their big homes, living in these communities. And the city of Portland is currently looking at investing in tiny homes, charging monthly rent between $250, $350. And the idea is that half of that money can roll into a fund that is creating more tiny home movements. And so right now it's a great conversation to have, seeing that we are looking for ways to have diversity of housing available within the city of Portland so that we can also have a home for diversity of incomes within the city of Portland. My personal concern is looking at that range that we are barely hitting people at the federal poverty guideline, because if you try to multiply the amount of rent that you'd have to pay, and what is a best practice right now is that 30% of your income or less should go towards housing. So if you are paying between $250 to $350 a month for your rent, if you are at the federal poverty line, you're really struggling to guarantee that you can afford to live there. So that's an issue that needs to be talked about. There are other groups also talking about the issue of tiny homes. Meyer Memorial Trust is also looking at how they can fund initiatives as well. Their emphasis is on the exurbs like Hood River, Marion, Yamhill, Polk counties. But it's definitely a conversation that is Portland's taking by the bullhorns before any other major city is. Other than that, I also want to point out Krista Grant. She's here in the crowd to give a wave. She's actually the research chair for the City Club's Homelessness and Healthcare Committee. And so one of the things that we're looking at is the rollout of the ACA, Obamacare. It's going to be saving a few of our governments in the area lots of money. It's also going to be saving some nonprofit social providers who do healthcare, who take Medicare dollars. It's going to save a lot of money in that way. And so one of the conversations we're having now is how do we make sure that that money that's being saved, we can invest more of that into affordable housing. I think that's all I have. Oh, I have one other thing. I did write an article recently for Blue Oregon about some of these issues from local, regional, statewide. And if you go online, you can also see some hyperlinks, which gives you links to some of the information as well on that. It's going around this way.
And I'll just wrap up by just kind of presenting some general policy ideas beyond what Omar was talking about that, that we can consider when we're trying to address some of these things. Cameron brought up the tiny house movement, which falls into a lot of other things that, you know, ways in which people are trying to address how to do infill, how to address the lack of affordability with the kind of what we already have. But it's also really important to draw the distinction, you know, is there a difference between a tiny house that's for a person with a very low income and a granny flat or an ADU that a homeowner is building to rent out for Airbnb? You know, they're not the same thing. And so when we have these discussions, it's always important to remember who and what purpose are you building it for, because those have implications. Same with what they're calling micro apartments. So there's a lot of debate right now because they're building apartments that or apartment buildings where the apartment doesn't have like a kitchen. It's a shared kitchen. It's almost like a dormitory style apartment. Places like in Hollywood and in Northwest, which could be great because that's a lower cost, but they're still renting at $800 to $1,000 for one of those 200 or 300 square foot buildings. So, you know, just because you allow it doesn't necessarily always mean it's going to be affordable. It might get affordable over time as the market kind of balances out, but you can't necessarily always assume that. And they could be putting in amenities like granite countertops and what have you that would keep it from being affordable because they're actually not going for that particular demographic. The same thing that happens when you tear down a home to build something new. Are you replacing it with a single family home? Or are you placing it with a duplex or a triplex that might actually preserve some of that affordability? And how does the zoning of that particular lot limit what you can build? Or what is the financing mechanisms that encourage you to build that giant luxury house as opposed to a cottage house? And what are the restrictions around that? And then we touched upon briefly inclusionary zoning. Does anyone not know what inclusionary zoning is? I feel like I'm a one-man note sometimes. So inclusionary zoning it's been around for 40 years. It's a national policy tool where jurisdictions use they say if you're a developer and you want to build a big complex, like say more than 20 or 30 or 40 units, we're going to require you to set aside some of those units as affordable. And in order to help you make that pencil out, we're going to give you some incentives. And so we're going to reduce how much parking you have to build, or we're going to help you get a faster permit, or maybe give you some tax abatements. But in Oregon, that the practice of actually mandating a strict amount of how much affordable housing has to be built, that is banned. And so the home builders effectively banned it in 1999, and we've been trying to fight that ever since. So what that means is that the city of Portland or Washington County, they can say, okay, we have these incentives for you, and we can ask you to build affordable housing, but we can't actually legally require you to do it. So it really takes the local control away from jurisdictions to address their own housing need and figure out if that's the right policy for them. And what some of the studies that have come out that show that cities that have inclusionary zoning policies, it's interesting because the market rate housing is actually a little bit smaller. And so that's another thing that developers will do to try to address those costs in order to build affordable housing within that development. And so because developers always scare you. They say, well, if you try to do this, then development will just stop. You know, we won't be able to build anything because it's so onerous. But there are ways in which they can adjust and the market adjusts to make sure that you're building housing for all income levels, not just the highest end.
And then another great thing that's happening here in Portland that's a growing national movement are community land trusts, where properties is actually taken off the private market, where a trust or a nonprofit, here it's called Proud Ground in Oregon, will buy a piece of property and they'll either develop the house themselves or it's an existing piece of property, and then they'll sell it to a qualified home buyer at a 30% discount or something like that. So what would normally cost $200,000 is more like $120,000. But the owner doesn't actually own the land, they just own the structure. And so when they want to go back and sell it, there's a formula in which they sell it to the next person and it's still affordable. So there's no 10 or 20 or 30 year covenant. It's affordable for as long as that property remains in the trust. And that's a good way that can be paired with a policy like inclusionary zoning, in order to maintain that affordability in perpetuity, without having to strain the public resources, because you just have to make the purchase one time and then it just stays affordable as long as it's in the trust. And at the national level, we can look at the mortgage interest deduction as a way to generate more resources. That expenditure is something around, I think, $80 billion a year, something around there. That's mostly going, so the mortgage interest deduction, if you have a mortgage, you get to write off the interest that you pay. And most of those benefits go to people that make more than $200,000 a year. So the majority goes to the quote-unquote 1%, and it's to the tune of something like $85 billion a year, which in comparison, HUD's budget is something around $45 billion a year. So if you were able to divert some of that money and turn it into like a tax credit, you could capture that and use that for Section 8 vouchers or affordable housing dollars, however you want to. And another idea is a renter tax credit. So if homeowners get a tax credit or deduction for being a homeowner, why do renters not get those same kinds of generous policies through our tax code just because they can't afford to buy? And those can be really cheap and equitable ways in which we can look at some of our national policies to kind of address what's happening here on the ground locally. If we want to think create big, you can talk about rent control and rent stabilization. That's certainly been part of the conversation since we've seen such an uptick in rents. It's been a priority for my organization for a long time, but we just haven't seen the opportunity until now. But if you want to have rent control, you can't do it without evictions protections. And that's something that we're focusing on right now, because Oregon is a no-cause eviction state, meaning that a landlord can evict you and not even tell you why. If they're still able to evict, but there are limits to their rent that they can raise, they can just kick you out and then raise the rent and then get somebody else new in there. So those two policies really have to work together in order to actually be effective.
And rent control is also illegal.
Also preempted at the state level, just like inclusionary zoning.
One thing I want to emphasize, that for housing policy in Oregon, it's really interesting because it's not just about policy. It's really about the politics. The real estate and home builder interests here give more money than any other industry. Their interests are very powerful. We have things like inclusionary zoning ban, rent control ban. 2 years ago, we had real estate transfer taxes banned, even though they're already statutorily banned. Now they're in the Constitution. And there's just more and more of that going on in Oregon. And even, for example, we have our property tax system, which is highly inequitable, also affects how housing can be affordable here. And so one of the things we really need to figure out is how do we build the political strength to really get rid of some of these barriers and correct the issues that we have in housing affordability.
You've been listening to a panel discussion, The State of Affordable Housing, Influences and Tools for the Future of Our Region, with speakers Justin Bury of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Omar Carrillo Tinajero of Neighborhood Partnerships, and Cameron Witten, community activist. We'll now hear an excerpt from the question and answer session for that panel.
I I wonder if you talk a little bit more about sort of the campaign history of inclusionary zoning. Do you have champions? Is it going to go forward in 2015?
It will go forward in 2015. And I know there's a bill submitted, but I don't know who the sponsor is. So we're going to be working. So CAT and another group that I belong to called Housing Land Advocates, we're part of the Oregon Inclusionary Zoning Coalition, which our main focus is to overturn the ban and also to encourage cities to adopt their own inclusionary zoning policies. And so we started in 2011, and we had a single hearing, and that was with our victory in 2011. And then in 2013 is when we saw a lot of mobilization, and we got a lot further than even some of our biggest allies thought we could, where we were, it technically got out of the House committee, but not really. They called it back, and which goes to show some of the funniness of Oregon state politics. And it is a really diverse, what's beautiful about the coalition, it's a diverse kind of non-typical housing groups, people like labor unions, community, different groups of color, different environmental or transportation related groups have signed on and say, you know, we can't have what we're pushing for unless we're building inclusive communities and people can live close to where they work or close to where there are good schools or close to where they can lead healthy and productive lives. And inclusionary zoning is a really good way to do that. It's not the only way, but it's a really good way to do that. So right now, there's two main oppositions. It's the home builders and the realtors, as Cameron mentioned. And so far, that's enough. But we have a lot of really good momentum going into this 2015 session. So I do think there's a good chance that we'll be able to overturn it. But at the same time, we need people like in this room to contact our local elected officials, like people in Metro and City Council, because they've kind of been a little bit on the sidelines with this issue and said, well, I don't see it as winnable yet. And so I'm not going to prioritize it yet. But it won't be winnable until we see their leadership and people in Salem see their leadership as well. And they start to look at what can be done here in Portland. What have we lost because we haven't had this for 15 years now in terms of what affordable housing could look like if we did have inclusionary zoning. They're simply not really looking at that at a deep enough level. And so it's up to us as the coalition, but also if you're in whatever your advocacy is, to say, hey, what have you done about inclusionary zoning lately? And where is your leadership on this? Because that, to me, has been the biggest lack of our allies and people saying, yeah, this is really important. I hate this ban. But then where are they showing up when it comes to that time to have a hearing? Or are they, you know, writing letters? Or are they showing, you know, our elected people in Salem that it is a priority for them so that there is some political will?
One thing I want to add is that under House Speaker Tina Kotek's leadership, housing issues have moved a lot further, including inclusionary zoning, including Section 8 reform. And so one of the things that really hinges on inclusionary zoning being available in the state is going to be the 2014 elections. And so, you know, the Democrats are looking to pick up seats, and I think that would give Tina Kotek more leverage, especially within the political community, to push something like this forward.
And was she the bill sponsor?
No. Jeff Reardon.
Jeff Reardon was.
And then Bob Jensen was our other main co-sponsor, and Peter Buckley was our co-sponsor.
You had a question, I think.
Yeah. So you mentioned Airbnb before, and I feel like that's been a lot of buzz, at least within my community. I rent a room, shared house.
Yeah.
And a lot of the rooms that would traditionally be on Craigslist are now being taken off of the market and are being put into Airbnb.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this hidden market because it's a private homeowner who's choosing whether or not to rent out a part of their house, and they have every right to decide that. But it takes a lot of housing options off of the market, and it's a sort of affordable housing that's, you know, sort of in the shadows because it's not units that are considered affordable housing, right? It's like a homeowner owns a house and offers a lot of options.
Right.
And I know that there's been talk in other states as to policies to protect Airbnb from taking over completely, or other similar organizations and businesses that are doing that kind of work. And I understand that it's an unintended consequence. I also know that Portland is like really gearing up for Airbnb, making this its new hub.
Right.
And I'm just wondering what the discussion looks like around that.
That's great, because actually we just wrapped up when Airbnb decided to put their headquarters, not their full headquarters, I think it's their customer service headquarters here, it was a little bit ironic because technically the practice of Airbnb was banned in Oregon or in Portland. So they say, well, we should do whatever we can to make sure that Airbnb is welcome here. So they quickly passed an ordinance that allowed what they call short-term rentals with single-family homes and duplexes and ADUs, accessory dwelling units. One thing that good that came out of that is that they are making it required that the host be a owner, the primary occupant. So it's not as though a unit is going to be empty for 9 months out of the year and then rented. It's supposed to be where it's somebody's living there regularly and they're either have an empty room or they're on vacation or what have you. The only problem is, and there is a registration process for them to verify that. The only problem is there's kind of a lack of enforcement about what that means. And there's a lack of data in terms of how these units are being rented out. And so my organization was part of this process that just wrapped up through the mayor's office about, do we want to do this for the multifamily housing? And the CAT, along with some of the landlord groups, had some real strong reservations about the short-term rental market as a whole. What kinds of impacts does it have on affordability and the long-term rental market? For me, it's not just that it might inch rents up, but it would be in specific areas that are already experiencing gentrification, because those are the types of areas where people will want to rent Airbnb, you know, with the coffee shops and the tourist amenities. And so it will be very localized, not necessarily like across the city. But then we also have, there's fair housing implications. So who if you're a host, who you're allowing a guest to be, if they're covered under the Fair Housing Act and you're being preferential in terms of, I don't want kids or I don't like the way this person looks or anything like that, you might be in violation of the Fair Housing Act. And then they also are saying, well, landlords should be getting tenants, if they want to be a host, they should be getting permission from their landlords. In order to do it, the landlord should do the registration, but how are the landlords choosing which tenants that they're allowing to rent out? And are there fair housing implications there? Is there saying, well, if you're a good tenant, I'll do it for you, I like you, and I don't like how you're asking for your rights, or I don't like what kind of food you're cooking, and so I'm not going to allow you to rent it. Those kinds of things already happen. We don't need to add more pressures into that kind of very tenuous relationship. The enforcement issue that I mentioned, it's going to be complaint-based with very little damages that if someone's in violation, that they'll have to pay. So we can imagine that this will be, unless somebody's going to sit down and look through the entire Airbnb page and be matching it up with who's registered and who not, I don't see a lot of robust enforcement that's going to take place. So, and we need education funding so that people are not setting themselves up or threatening their tenancy or threatening the livelihood of their neighbors and the peace and quiet enjoyment that their neighbors deserve by renting it out. And so there needs to be a robust education around this. I know that New York and San Francisco have effectively banned this type, or they're considering it.
So then I have a friend who now works at Airbnb, and he says that New York is still their biggest market.
Right, and so they're just doing it totally illegally. I'm not against having, if you have an extra guest room and you want to rent it out, I think that's great. If you're going on vacation and you want to make some extra cash while you're away for a week, that's great. But if you're a landlord and you're clearing out an apartment of a real long-term tenant to make that available for maybe a hotel, essentially, then that really causes some problems. Not only for the renter population at large, but the people that you're also renting out to that are neighbors of that apartment.
So what else I find interesting about that is, city council doesn't really know, for the rooms that are in Airbnb, you know, what would happen to them if there was an Airbnb in Portland? Right. And so, you know, if you went to any of the city council meetings, there were people who were, you know, senior who went to testify saying they would be out of their home if they weren't renting. There were students saying they were paying their way through college if they weren't renting. So there's a lot of different stories, and, you know, city council doesn't really have an answer to that. What they did in response was actually make a maximum of how many units inside of a house, because right now it's still banned for apartments. They're still evaluating whether that should be legal because of the hotel issue. But looking within houses, no more than 2 units can be used for Airbnb. So that way that it really is making sure that there is residential activities happening. Other than that, one thing that's a really important conversation is looking at the hospitality taxes that are being collected by Multnomah County. So there's a lot of revenue coming in, and where is that going? So that's another big issue, is if we are going to be allowing something like Airbnb in town, let's make sure that we're also addressing the impacts it has on affordable housing.
Okay. Yeah, Jeff Strang with Common Ground Oregon, Washington. So we're offering the same proposal we did in 2013 to the legislature to put a ballot measure up that would change the Constitution to institute a 4% privately owned land value tax that would fund a residence dividend along the lines of the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. So that would definitely be an affordable housing proposal.
Thanks, Jeff.
I have a question I hear a lot about like housing market forces talked about in a way that seems like there's somebody pulling the strings. And I hear a lot of other consumer choice conversations that kind of recognize the power of the consumer. And I'm interested in what you would have to say about making like ethical housing choices as we all will probably make a lot of housing choices in this city and have made a lot of those choices. Like how, given that not all of us can work in housing policy,
right.
What can we do in choosing where we live and who we purchase from to make help the system along?
And we'll see about getting the response from that panel on the website at kboo.fm. This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:01 a.m. Coming up next, we hear Flashpoints. Investigative news radio from our brothers and sisters, cousins and so on. At KPFA in Berkeley. And we thank them for that. And I thank you, dear listener,